Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. World leaders are meeting for a second week in Paris in an attempt to negotiate an international agreement to deal with climate change. But while nearly 200 nations struggle to agree on targets for reducing carbon emissions, it's actually cities that would play a large role in making progress toward those targets, changing transportation infrastructure, making contracts with local utilities for renewable energy, and adopting green building codes. Cities around the world are responsible for upwards of three-quarters of CO2 emissions, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says urban areas are where the largest opportunities for cutting greenhouse gases lie. Which cities are doing the most to reduce their carbon footprint? What can we do to make our own communities more sustainable? How can cities cooperate across national boundaries to reduce their carbon footprints? And with a Republican Congress opposing federal action, is it up to cities to lead the way? Joining me to discuss what cities can do to lead the fight against climate change are Guillermo Rodriguez, Policy and Communications Director for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. Guillermo serves as an expert witness before both the California Public Utilities Commission and the State Energy Commission, and he joins me here in our studios. Guillermo, great to have you with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
And with us also is Dr. Kif Schuyer. He is the Climate Change Program Director at the Local Government Commission. His work focuses on supporting local government climate change initiatives, and he oversees the California Adaptation Forum, the only statewide conference dedicated to preparing for the risks posed by climate change. He joins us on the line from Sacramento. Welcome to Your Call, Kif. And with us from Paris is Dr. Elizabeth Sahn. She's co-founder and co-director of Climate Interactive, a not-for-profit organization based in Washington, D.C., which helps people see what works to address climate change. And she is at the climate conference in Paris. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Sahn. And as always on Your Call, we want you to participate in the program. If you are someone who is active at the grassroots in fighting climate change, someone trying to get your city or county or neighborhood to reduce its carbon footprint, what have you learned? What's most important? And what do you want to know? And if you are someone who's following the climate change issue, global warming as a whole, and wondering what role that local and municipality at the local level, what can make change, we invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or best of all, you can post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. Do we have Elizabeth Sahn? Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Great to have you. Thanks so much for being on the program. And I wanted to ask, so if you could talk, this last week, there was a lot of coverage of the mayors who gathered at the Climate Summit for Local Leaders that was held at Paris City Hall. The mayor of the city of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, was there. Also Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York, who's the current UN Secretary General, Special Envoy for Cities and Climate Change, and a whole bunch of mayors from around the globe. What were they there to do, and what kind of impact do you see them making in this conference in Paris?
Yeah, well, that event you mentioned, and actually, events every day, there's a little bit of an echo on the line. I don't know if anyone can do anything about that.
We'll work on that. Sorry about that.
Sure. That important event, they had, I believe, up to 400 mayors who've now signed on to something called the Compact of Mayors, Commitment to Sustainability and Action on Climate Change. There have been events at the site where the negotiators are meeting, also has a large civil society presence, and there's delegations from cities around the world, organizations like C40, which is the 40 megacities that involve focusing together on addressing climate change, having events, ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability, doing a similar thing. I'd say the mayors and their staff are there. They're learning from each other. They're sharing what's working across their different regions. And also, I'd say, encouraging the national governments to do what they can to send a really strong signal that the world is moving in this direction of ambitious action on climate change.
So Guillermo Rodriguez, San Francisco, one of those cities that is involved in this effort. Talk about what you understand as what's happening in Paris right now when it comes to cities taking action, and what it means for a city like San Francisco.
Sure. San Francisco like many other cities across the world, when central governments failed the last COPE meeting to come to a consensus or an agreement around reductions of emissions and being able to be transparent about what those things are. I think cities worldwide took it upon themselves to lead where their central governments were unwilling to lead. And as you mentioned in your opening statement, when you think about emissions, that 75% of all emissions are generated by cities, cities really do have the ability to make a difference. And mayors from throughout the world, including here in San Francisco and throughout the Bay Area, have been, you know, leading experts, leading in cities in trying to reduce kind of our carbon footprint. And really, frankly, I think the fact that we're not seeing in the news central governments fighting each other and being unwilling to sign some kind of, you know, international agreement, now we're just really talking about to what extent developing countries will provide resources for, you know, up-and-coming countries. And it really is, I think, all the work that was done by cities worldwide to show that you can have a positive, growing economy and reduce emissions. And I think that has been the big statement that mayors have been making in their own cities, and they're saying that in Paris.
I mean, San Francisco has been a leader in showing what, you know, how cities can make a commitment to reducing carbon emissions. A goal, my understanding, right, 80% reduction by 2050?
That's a big goal that San Francisco has.
It's a pretty ambitious goal. So what does it matter if, whether it's San Francisco or any other city, provided they're making a local commitment, what's the importance of signing on to some kind of, you know, international compact?
For cities like San Francisco and others, the reason we sign on to these agreements is that, A, it's an opportunity for San Francisco to learn from other cities in terms of best practices. What are they doing that we can implement in San Francisco? We look at, you know, cities like Rio or others who are doing, you know, BRT, bus rapid transit lines. And we're here in San Francisco. We're looking at how to develop that on Geary Street. So that's one reason. The second reason is that the ability for cities to come together under these compacts allow for a shared methodology, a shared protocol on how to report data.
And why does that matter?
That matters because then we can be able to compare apples to apples, oranges to oranges, look at whether their city's unique aspects or changes in policy allow them to reduce emissions. And so it really does create a baseline, and it creates a sense of accountability, a barometer, if you will, to show that cities are making a change, how we're changing over time, and where opportunities are to make further commitments.
I want to bring in Kif Schurer. Kif, you work with cities and counties around California on these questions. I don't think many people would be surprised to hear that San Francisco might be a leader when it comes to sustainability, thinking about those questions. But there's a lot of other significant cities in the state, and I especially think of, like, not necessarily on the coast, where this might not be as much of a no-brainer. And I'm wondering kind of what progress has been made in bringing more cities and more counties into these kind of efforts.
That's a great question. You're right. It's happening all over California. And in fact, it's happening, I think, all over the country, where cities, city leadership in particular, who see the effects of climate change in their own backyards, are recognizing that this is something they have to do, they want to do, and because they work in the public sector, they're looking to their peers to find solutions. So folks in the Central Valley are looking to their peers, and the city of Fresno has been leading the charge on a lot of fronts. They've got this amazing home energy tune-up program that they developed, piloted, and ran out, and it's been wildly successful because it's putting energy savings back in the pocket of Fresno residents that they can use in their own homes. You've got the city of Lancaster in southern inland area, with Mayor Rex Paris, who's a Republican, who feels that he's one of the first cities to make a net zero community commitment for the city, because he recognizes it's good for the city, it's good for the community, and it's good for business. So you're seeing a lot of solutions like this cropping up, where local governments who really do feel, and this has been, for me, one of the compelling stories of the climate action movement is that local governments are the stewards of the people's will, and they really act that way in ways that our national governments have not been. So we're seeing them responding to the very real circumstances. You've got in Southeast Florida, four counties came together to form the Southeast Florida Climate Compact because, politics aside, they recognize that they're at risk and they're taking action despite what's happening in their state.
When you talk about action being taken in Lancaster, this is definitely not blue state America, right? This is a very different kind
not.
Of place. And what do you think has made change there in terms of consciousness for local leaders?
Well, I think it was a real forward-looking leader in Mayor Paris particularly, but somebody who recognized the opportunity for distributed energy, the opportunity for renewable energy. They have an incredible solar resource up there, and the fact that over time, as you look at this thing, energy prices are going to go up through fossil fuel mechanisms. And so by embedding renewable energy into the fabric of the community, they're creating actually a more resilient economy. And I think to some of the comments that were made from Paris and from San Francisco about why measure this stuff, why take action at the local level, because, you know, cities, mayors, council members are responsible. They're the stewards for the well-being of their community. And this is an issue that affects the well-being of the community on so many levels. So by creating tools and resources to measure your climate action progress, your ability to adapt to climate change, you're really putting your community in a better position to thrive. And frankly, the ones that thrive are going to be the ones that look at all these indicators, track it, and work towards solutions, because also resources are limited. These are going to be expensive in some cases. Actions to take to mitigate against these things or adapt to climate change. And we don't have endless resources, so we need to be smart about how we use them.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will return to the program tomorrow. But today we are continuing our series about climate solutions, talking specifically about the role that cities, both here in California and worldwide, are playing in reducing carbon emissions and combating global warming. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're getting a number of folks calling and writing already. We'll get to you in just a moment, but I want to reintroduce our guest, Dr. Kif Shure. You're just hearing from him. He's the Climate Change Program Director at the Local Government Commission here in California. Guillermo Rodriguez is Communications Director for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. And on the line from Paris, we're talking to Dr. Elizabeth Son, who's co-founder and co-director of Climate Interactive. Dr. Son, we were just talking right now with Kif about, you know, these many, this diverse cities in California that are taking action on climate change. One thing I want to know, when you hear about Copenhagen or Seattle leading the way globally around climate change, you go, yeah, well, Copenhagen, they're always at the forefront of this kind of stuff, right? It's no surprise. But I'd be interested in you watching this develop and the movement of cities taking action on this front. Where are some of the cities, maybe from the developing world or from places we might not expect, who are leading the way?
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked that, because one place that's close to my heart is the city of Milwaukee, which you may not, you know, think of as a Portland or a Seattle, but they're showing really, to me, inspiring leadership, and I think driven by two of the things that have already come up. One is starting to feel climate impacts, so they've had some extreme rain events with stormwater problems, recognizing the multiple benefits that come from some of these sustainability solutions. So real leadership there we're seeing from the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District. So another interesting thing about cities is leadership comes from many directions, sometimes the mayor's offices, other times other parts of the cities. And then really interesting collaboration with civil society groups that include NGOs that care about water quality, community health clinics that care about the health of the people in neighborhoods, and a recognition that the sustainability solution, in this case, they're focusing on green infrastructure, so things like green roofs and rain gardens. Those are wins for public health. They're wins for jobs. They're wins for climate, in that buildings with green roofs have less energy use, and they save money for the sewage district because there's less stormwater getting into the wastewater treatment stream. So I think that's another thing. Cities are this point of intersection between all these systems and all of these benefits, and people are really starting to see the ways in which there are some key solutions that are at the intersection that provide a big opportunity to save money and get things done.
I was looking on this compact of mayors that so many cities have signed on to. I was looking specifically for cities in China and cities in India. And I'm wondering, Guillermo, I mean, I tell you what I found. No cities from China. Four cities in India, which are not the biggest cities in India. And yet people are saying when it comes to addressing this globally, we can't do this without China and India, and certainly not without the large cities there.
Certainly, China and the cities there are huge. They need to be involved. They need to be engaged. And while they may not have been able to sign to date this compact, they have been very active with C40, for example. And San Francisco has a great relationship.
And what is C40 for those of us?
C40 is Climate 40. It's an organization that represents the 40 largest cities worldwide, including Shanghai in China and Beijing, and two very large cities worldwide in China, who are really committed to looking at climate and emissions. And through C40 and San Francisco's leadership, we have a great relationship with China. San Francisco has offices in Beijing and Shanghai. We have a longstanding sister relationship with Shanghai. And we've been working together to identify, best practices. I think there's a lot of change happening in China. I think there's recognition that climate is something that's very important to the citizens there. I think mayors have been engaged. We've hosted them here in San Francisco and engaged. I think they're looking at least the things that San Francisco has been able to help China think about is really our zero waste policy. When you think about all the material that we generate and how we recycle it, how we get our organics out of our waste stream, how we turn that into compost, that's kind of the level of engagement we've been working with. And it's important because that's one thing that San Francisco has recognized internationally is our ability to achieve zero waste. And we have a bold, audacious goal to do that by 2020. So we're fully engaged in this effort. And we think the cities in China are coming along.
I want to bring on a caller who's called up to 866-798-8255 to join the conversation. Judy is in San Francisco, and she wanted to talk about work that she and her colleagues are doing to oppose climate change. Welcome, Judy.
Yes, hello. It's not really me and my colleague. Well, in a sense it is. It's my union, but also my city. The Board of Supervisors, I believe, made a resolution to disinvest from fossil fuels. And so our pension funds, for example, are supposed to be disinvesting from fossil fuels, and we are. And I'm proud of my union, SEIU 10-1, because we're holding their feet to the fire about this. when they wanted to go into hedge funds, we were trying to stop them, and we partially succeeded, because the hedge funds are not transparent, and they do invest heavily in fossil fuels. So that's kind of an indirect way that that the cities can help climate change.
Thanks so much, Judy. Obviously, pension funds, that's big money. It can have an impact. Guillermo, what are we seeing in the Bay Area around this?
Certainly, what San Francisco is doing, thanks to our organized workforce. You heard one of our largest unions, SEIU, has been a big leader in looking at pension funds in San Francisco. I think the other thing that we're doing here in San Francisco, the mayor, Mayor Lee, happened to be invited to the Vatican earlier this summer by the Pope. He convened a conclave of leaders to talk about the environment. And one of the biggest, the announcement that Mayor Lee made at the Vatican was the city's commitment to literally disinvest our current muni fuels, which we use diesel. We have some biodiesel. We certainly have electric. But for those muni fleet that still use diesel, the mayor announced that we're switching over completely to a renewable diesel format. And again, efforts about reducing emissions, thinking very creatively. It has to happen at all different levels, from what our unions are supporting around pension funds, the mayor's announcement that we're switching fuels today in our city bus fleet, our city cars, our fire engines. Again, it's all these small efforts. But again, our whole effort is how to reduce San Francisco's overall footprint.
Kif Shear, what are you seeing statewide around these kind of questions, particularly around the divestment question of taking funds out of fossil fuel industries?
Well, I think there's definitely two sides to it, and I'm glad we're talking about the financing of climate action, because I think there's the divestment movement, which looks at how, you know, what strategies might be supporting fossil fuel as a whole, but there's also the wholesale shifting of valuation that's happening. And I want to applaud San Francisco, whose TUC adopted a sea level rise checklist for their future investments. So this is a different way of shifting where your resources are spent to a more climate positive framework. So the city now has to go through a process, Guillermo could probably clarify it a bit, but to evaluate the sea level rise impacts before they make investments. And the city spends, I think the estimate is, you know, in the billions of dollars on infrastructure over the next 10 years. The state similarly is starting to look at how do they spend their infrastructure funding, which is, you know, massive, and where are they accounting for climate change in that? And we're seeing a lot more discussion of that shifting in valuation, which is going to have a profound effect on the financing of these efforts, because if you just look at first cost and least cost opportunities, you can make some pretty maladaptive investments, putting up projects in areas that are going to be impacted by sea level rise or heat.
Explain Jerry, so first cost, maladaptive, explain what those things mean to, in this situation.
Oh, sure. You know, if I just look at the lowest cost for a project, I'm going to make certain choices. But if I look at the long-term impacts of my choices, I might make a very different choice. For example, I'll pick on San Francisco. You got a lot of shoreline there. If they didn't consider the fact that sea levels were going to rise, they might allow development in some areas that are going to be inundated in just, you know, a matter of decades. But when you build a building, it's going to last for 40 and 50 years. So by taking into consideration those impacts, they make different choices, different investments, and that can shift the balance to produce a community that's adapting to climate change, that's able to respond and more resilient to the impacts of climate change. The city of LA passed one of the first, I think it's the first in the nation, cool roof ordinance. So you've got a situation where the city has a lot of heat, and there's this issue called the urban heat island effect, where urban areas, because they have a lot of dark absorptive surfaces, get hotter. And we're getting warmer days and warmer nights, and that's creating some extreme heat situations. And so one of the strategies that you can adopt is to use literally cooler surfaces, reflective surfaces. And the city adopted this ordinance, which has a couple of benefits. Elizabeth mentioned the green roof opportunity. Well, cool roofs also have the opportunity to reduce energy use. They don't have as much stormwater benefit, but they do have the ability to reduce that energy use, but they also create less extreme heat in buildings where people might be subjected to those heat and stresses. And so you're creating a two-pronged strategy. But if you just looked at the initial costs or didn't factor those future changing temperatures into it, why would you adopt that strategy? So looking long-term in the way that you're spending your own money, as well as the kinds of money that you might have through pension funds, is going to shift a lot of the balance of, and we're seeing more and more of that. You see, City of Richmond is a great example. They have been a very historically underserved community, economically stressed. Mayor Butts, who's one of our board members, is also in Paris right now talking about some of their work. And they joined the Marin Clean Energy, the Community Choice Aggregation Program. This is where local governments are taking over the choices of who purchases and what kinds of energy is purchased for the community.
Kiff, we have to go to a break in just a moment, so I'm going to cut in there. And we definitely want to come back to talk about community choice aggregation. We've actually had some folks writing in at feedback@yourcallradio.org wanting to know about that. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And during this week in which we're focusing on climate solutions, today we're talking specifically about the role that cities can play globally and here in California when it comes to reducing greenhouse gases. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Is always better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Again, it's a toll-free call. You can also send your question or comment via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today, Donald Trump's comments continue to lead BBC news bulletins as the most read on BBCNews.com, one of the major talking points on social media. Is Trump changing the view of the U.S.? We'll get some perspectives from around the world. We'll also talk to some Trump supporters and Muslims in the U.S. And Anu Anand in Delhi with guests on what it's like to living there right now. The air pollution is a big issue for people in the region. That's World Have Your Say from the BBC coming up at 11 o'clock.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. You can always find more information about the program at yourcallradio.org. We archive all our programs there, so you can listen if you've missed any of today's show or any other one you've heard that you're interested in. As we continue this week of talking about climate change and solutions to it, tomorrow we're going to be talking about Exxon's role in funding climate-denying science. And on Thursday, we're going to look at which countries are leading in renewable energy development. If you ever have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or if you want to join the conversation today, the number is 866-798-8255. If you are someone who has been part of an effort at the municipal level, at the county level, at the grassroots, saying what can we do here to do our part to reduce carbon emissions, if you have questions about what's happening on this front in Paris right now, this is a great time to call and be part of the conversation. The number again, 866-798-TALK. Joining with us on the program from Paris is Dr. Elizabeth Sawn. She's co-founder and co-director of Climate Interactive, a nonprofit organization based in Washington, which helps people see what works to address climate change. All on the line with us from Sacramento is Dr. Kif Schuyer. He's the Climate Change Program Director at the Local Government Commission. And here in studio with me is Guillermo Rodriguez, Policy and Communications Director for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. We've had a couple of emails come in from people who want to talk about specific policy changes they think could make a difference. One of them came from Mary, and she says, I wonder how cost-effective it might be for all of the Bay Area cities that belong to the Association of Bay Area Governments to purchase solar panels for their government-owned buildings. So let's hold on to that idea, the question of solar panels for government buildings. And then Sarah writes in to say, I hope you talk about public transit and the fact that the number of small transit agencies in the Bay Area makes it tough to move forward on a coordinated approach. And so she wants to know what might be done about that. And finally, we want to get back to community choice aggregation, which Kip was talking about before we went to break. Guillermo, where do you want to jump in there?
I think probably on community choice aggregation here in San Francisco. We talk about the role that residents can play and businesses. Frankly, the biggest thing that residents and businesses can do is when the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission begins to offer our version of CCA, community choice aggregation, in 2016, just a month away, is to sign up for it. San Francisco may be a little bit of a latecomer to the Bay Area in this game, but a big player in this effort. And, you know, when you think about climate change and the role of cities, it really is our residents and our businesses that contribute to that effort. There are so many things that individuals can do. In San Francisco, we have a very easy campaign when we think about climate. It's 050-100. Zero waste. 50% of all trips that we take in the city should be on sustainable modes, either public transit, walk, or biking. Or if you have to drive, you should be driving an electric vehicle, and we're building infrastructure for that. And then 100% is to source all our energy from renewable sources, and community choice aggregation really is going to be a great vehicle for us to get to that goal.
And what about obviously, cities are themselves, the city governments, their agencies are big users of energy. Is there a move in San Francisco to both put solar on the roofs of its buildings and also to try to coordinate with other cities in the area?
San Francisco is really lucky in the sense that, again, early adopters trying to be leaders in so many different areas. When you think of solar installation on government buildings, just look at City Hall. We have solar on our City Hall. If you look across the street at Davies Symphony Hall, we have solar there. Our Public Utilities Commission is working with our school district to put solar on rooftops of our schools. If you look at the U.S. Postal Service, their carport at their large facility here in the Bayview area has solar. But we're not just looking at public-owned buildings. San Francisco also believes that we need our residents and businesses to engage in solar. So not only are there tax incentives, not only is there an incentive through the state, but San Francisco, we put up our own municipal money to support low-income families, to support nonprofit housing corporations who house low-income people, to be able to put solar onto their facilities. So we're really looking at it in a very holistic way. And the upside is that in San Francisco, we also look at solar installation in the context of developing green jobs. So we really kind of marry good things for the environment, good things for climate, but equally around linking that to good jobs for San Francisco residents.
I'm going to bring in Trevor. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Kiff, and then we'll bring in Trevor.
Mention a couple other things along those lines. One, the Bay Area actually has been pioneering an aggregated or group purchase program for municipal solar. It was led initially in Silicon Valley and then in Alameda County and in Marin. And these are examples where local governments are coming together to share the upfront burdens, the analysis and the figuring out and the costing, and actually get some bulk purchasing out there. And I think the latest one in Alameda County had 186 facilities and 31 megawatts of power went into contract, and that's, you know, almost 1,000 jobs, $100 million in savings. So local governments are recognizing that coming together works.
If I'm living in a community and I want to know, is my city taking advantage of this opportunity, how do I do that? How would you make sure, if I want to advocate on behalf of participation in that program, what's the best way to find out?
You know, asking your city council is probably the best route. Most cities in California particularly tend to trumpet their environmental activities, and many cities will have a webpage dedicated to climate action or sustainability. It's a great place to find out what's going on. Some of these, you know, municipal procurement's not something that a lot of citizens are going to get excited about, so it may be take a little digging and a little asking, but generally there's going to be a staff person at the city who's at least trying to help folks be aware of these opportunities. And then for the more actual residential action programs that might be going on, whether it's participation in a community choice aggregation, you should be getting information directly from the organization, the city or the county, whoever's running the program. Or there may be something like a home energy upgrade program that's available. There's a statewide program called Energy Upgrade California that folks can participate in. They have a statewide portal. There's a lot of resources out there now, but, you know, hopefully the city's doing a good job of telling their own story, but it's worth asking if they're not.
I want to bring in Trevor from Mill Valley, who's been waiting online. Trevor, welcome to your call.
Thank you very much. I've been working on climate change issues for years, and I find lots of people care about climate change tremendously. But because it's a global issue, they tend to think about needing a global policy, at least a national policy. And at that level, your average citizen really just can't have much influence. What I'm really interested in that you're talking about is the importance of city-level policies. That's somewhere where your average citizen could have significant influence, could really make a difference if they knew where to go. And so my question is, where would these interested citizens, they may be doing some things on their own at home, but at a policy level, what government branches should they talk to? What types of nonprofits are doing policy work at a city level? How do they get involved in city-level climate policy?
Maybe we can take that one very quickly around our panel. Elizabeth Son in Paris, any specific approach or resources you would direct Trevor to?
Well, I think one opportunity is, because these issues touch on so many sectors, what I see is actually entry points almost everywhere. So if your connection is to city governance, then you can talk to your city council person about the codes and ordinances. If you're connected to jobs, then you can look, is there a good jobs training program for these kind of jobs, like energy efficiency retrofits or green infrastructure installation. If your connection is asthma and children's health, then you can ask really hard questions about what are the air pollution levels in your city, because a lot of the solutions to air pollution are also solutions to climate change. So it may be one of these really fortuitous circumstances where it's a question of what's your passion, because pretty much all of them have an angle in once you get to this level of a city where everything is so interconnected.
Guillermo, what would you add?
I certainly, all those are excellent portals. I certainly invite listeners to engage in San Francisco through our department, and they can gain access to us online at sfenvironment.org. And there's a whole list of activities where residents as individuals can participate in climate change efforts. If you're a business, what things you can do to contribute to San Francisco's goal of reducing our carbon footprint. There are lots of different ways, again, depending on your interest, where to get involved and where to get engaged.
So it's really about thinking about, if you're concerned about this, trying to think of what's the specific area where you have some kind of passion or connection or ability to act, some knowledge you might bring to it, and then to engage with local government.
Correct.
Around that. Let's go next to Bill in Richmond. Bill, good to have you on your call. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Actually, this is very relevant to the last call. So I'm actually a citizen of Richmond, as you mentioned. And very recently, they just finished a very lengthy EIR process for a Chevron modernization project. It's actually scoped out, I think, in 2005 and just finally got approved by the city council. The point being is that anytime you have any sort of a modernization project or industrial construction project, you have permits that are under the purview of the AHJ, in that case, the city of Richmond. That allows the city of Richmond to then engage all of the environmental quality laws that the state has on the books. So we have the California Environmental Quality Act, which is sort of the state version of NEPA. And now you bring in this whole process of an environmental review. And through that environmental review, ultimately, it actually allowed the state attorney general's office to actually step in and literally make a significant difference in the greenhouse gas emissions that were originally being proposed. The way that Chevron actually framed that whole debate was that they claimed there was no net increase, when in actuality they were simply buying offsets off the carbon trade system that we have in the state, which was set up by state legislation AB 32. But the point being is that anytime you have an environmental review process, whether it's an EIR through a state process or an EIS through the federal government, there's public comment that's allowed, and you can literally go in and try to affect the debate. And in this case, the City Council of Richmond did really try to affect the debate as well, although ultimately they were probably bought off. But fortunately, the state was able to get involved based on the state law surrounding greenhouse gas emissions as well.
Bill, I just want to cut in because I want to get a response from our guests. We've got a lot of folks on the line. Kif, talk about this opportunity that's presented when there, say, is going to be an upgrade of a facility or something like that, how citizens get involved in those environmental reviews, and what role specifically when it comes to carbon emissions is that, you know, is that part of what's in the environmental review process at this point?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We definitely strongly support citizen engagement in the process, and we do feel that, by and large, local governments are responsive to citizens, especially on these issues. I think, as I mentioned earlier, we see local governments wanting to innovate. They recognize that they have limited resources, but they want to protect their citizens, and so they're trying to look for effective ways to move forward. Some of these things are seen as job or economic growth opportunities. You know, Richmond is building one of the largest, I think the largest solar installation in the region, and in part doing that to both stimulate jobs and shift their reliance away from the fossil fuel industries that have been so prevalent there. So there's a chance to weigh in and make those voices heard, and that's clearly important. I think when it comes to carbon emissions, we have some really interesting legislation in California. We hope that becomes a model for the state. One of those is SB 375, which looks to create regional plans around transportation and housing. And the goal there is to recognizing, and this was a new thing when it was passed in 2008, to link housing choices, housing development patterns, and transportation because of the ways that those impact greenhouse gas emissions. And so folks have an opportunity to weigh in at the regional level, and those regional plans set the thresholds, they set the levels by which other projects can then apply for and be approved. And so if we look across the whole region in any of these, whether it's the Bay Area or LA, they all have what's called a sustainable community strategy that sets the upper limits for greenhouse gas emissions and sets the criteria. And then developers in local regions can respond to those. And it's an effort to make it more streamlined and consistent and contribute to a net reduction in emissions across the board. And having a structure like that enables us, citizens and policymakers, to engage in the dialogue about how any given project fits into that larger goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So it very much becomes hopefully a carrot, but sometimes a stick if needed in order to make sure that we're all moving in the same direction.
Let's hear from Greg, who's calling in from Palo Alto. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks. A couple of questions, or not questions, comments. I live in Palo Alto, and there are two entities here, obviously, that have a major impact, the city of Palo Alto and Stanford University. And I've lived here for a long time. And although I think there's probably not a human on the planet who doesn't know something about climate change and the potential disaster this could pose, I don't see my city, Palo Alto, or Stanford going gung-ho to try and solarize, green everything, every public entity in the city, every building should be covered with solar. Stanford should be doing the same thing, and it's not happening. Stanford and Palo Alto are making some efforts, but that's not happening here. And it makes me wonder why residents need to apply pressure to politicians. I mean, I know they have to do that, but it seems to me that there's no city council member in Palo Alto or nobody at the state level, Governor Brown, anybody. They know what the problem is. Where's the will to do this? And I think that, so that's one thing. Secondly, I'd like to see Palo Alto just go off the grid. We own our own utilities. There's no reason that every public building in this city couldn't be covered, with solar and try to go to alternative energy. So let me make a suggestion, because funding is a big issue. CalSTRS and CalPERS just recently, I think, both voted on divestment from fossil fuels. I think that's great. But those people are sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars, literally, of money in their portfolios. And it seems to me that in addition to divestment from fossil fuel, that money, instead of being invested in risky things like the stock market, ought to be going to investment in infrastructure, particularly solar. This is the biggest issue that we're facing, human beings are facing. So I have one last suggestion. There ought to be a contest in the United States. Get some of these rich people that claim to be into the environment. Get them to put up $500 million or $1 billion and just say, hey, look, when we're going to have a contest and we're going to see which municipality, which county, which state can go as green as possible, and the winner is going to get $1 billion.
So an X Prize for cities and climate change is what you're talking about. Well, Greg, I love the constructive ideas, and I love the fact that I know that in our audience there are a lot of people in those pension plans you're talking about who probably want to be starting this conversation or maybe are already involved in it. And I definitely want to hear from you if you're living in a city in the Bay Area where you're either really excited about what's happening or you're dissatisfied. You have questions. You say, why aren't we taking more aggressive action on this? I invite you to call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. I actually want to go to Tom in San Francisco, who's next up on the line. Tom, welcome to your call.
Yes, hello. I've got a mailer from the Sierra Club for this past election, the San Francisco's dirty landfill deal. The garbage plant stinks. They're usually not too far off the mark. And the other question I have is the Board of Supervisors just passed an ordinance allowing a $1 billion condo going up on the Embarcadero, where the Embarcadero, right across, it's 75 Howard, it's right across from the Gap building, 250 Embarcadero. And on King tides, the Embarcadero at that area gets flooded. So if global warming is going to happen, why are we building a huge condo for billionaires right across the street? And I'll take your answer off on the radio.
Thanks so much. Guillermo, responses to either of these issues. And actually, I'd be interested, when it comes to landfills, I think a lot of people may not think of that as a climate issue. So maybe you could talk about the context around that.
Sure. Let's start there. I think in San Francisco, the biggest thing that we're engaged with is the whole idea of trying to get to send nothing to the landfill. I mean, that is our ultimate goal and ultimate aim. San Francisco already, 80% of all the material that we produce in San Francisco is diverted from the landfill, one of the highest in North America, and we continue to make strides there. We need our residents and businesses to do a better job at source separating out their recyclables from the black bin, as well as their organics, so that we can go out and compost them and do those kinds of activities. With respect to development in San Francisco, we talked earlier about the city's overall capital plan. And this is the infrastructure plan for the city. And we're one of the first cities in the country to add, you know, the impacts of climate change, the impacts of sea level rise. If you think of San Francisco, two-thirds of our town is surrounded by water, so clearly impacted by, you know, not only king tides, but long-term. And so all of the development that's happening along the waterfront, all of the intended thinking about our major infrastructure, if you think our roadways, you think of Caltrain, you think of all, you know, our airport, all right along the waterfront, important investments. And these are the things that we have to begin to look at and strategize and develop land use plans that address these items. And that's what the city is grappling with today.
I want to ask Elizabeth, I know we had a listener, Greg, who was talking about, hey, where are these great wealthy environmentalists in action they may or may not be taking to really put these issues up front? I mean, on the opening day of the Paris climate talks, Bill Gates announced plans to work with 19 governments, a bunch of other billionaires from around the world, in what's being described as the largest public-private partnership when it comes to funding renewable clean energy. What was the reaction to that in Paris when you were there, and how important do you think that kind of action is towards really making change happen?
I think any announcement like that generates a lot of excitement, and certainly it's a contribution in the right direction. We know that in the second half of the century, we're going to need new technologies that we don't have today. But a lot of the focus in Paris, I think rightly, is on deploying what we already have in place and know how to do. And so the nitty-gritty of rolling out wind and solar wherever possible, changing how we think about urban design for really compact cities that people move about by foot and by bicycle, by public transportation, making sure that the cities that are developing, the emerging cities and the rapidly developing economies, avoid some of the problems like sprawl that we see, you know, unfortunately too much in the U.S. and follow a much more compact growth pattern. So we need everything, and investments in R&D, you know, we're going to be very grateful for those eventually, but we can't also take our eye off the ball of the simple practical things that we know how to do, and I think, like the caller says, mostly just need to muster the political will and the determination to get going on.
So let me just ask, say you're not one of the cities that's the one of the great leaders globally around this, and you were saying, here is the one or two areas that we would, you know, most, if we really wanted to cut into our carbon footprint, what would those areas be?
Well, I think transportation is a huge one, and the footprint of buildings. Buildings use a tremendous amount of energy. So making sure that for new construction, the codes are set so that buildings are super energy efficient, and focusing on retrofitting the existing stock, which is also a great opportunity for young people in a city. Those are good jobs that can't be outsourced. And I think the second one that I would pick, interesting what the other panelists would say, but the other one I would pick would be compact urban design, which so much increases the quality of life and saves on greenhouse gases, has massive public health benefits at the same time.
Guillermo, from what San Francisco has learned, what would you say, where were those key areas where just like you make the most progress most quickly in terms of making a difference?
Certainly the examples that were just given by the previous caller, I think, are great examples. It's the ability, when you think of your transit system and getting people out of cars and how to do that, is extremely efficient and important that folks need to think about. In San Francisco, buildings and transportation represent 50% of all the emissions that we do. So, again, cities to identify where their emissions are coming from is important, and then to begin to tackle those areas. And again, all cities have the responsibility of disposing of their waste. And that's why we really think that that's something very simple that every municipality has a responsibility today to reduce waste. And so, recycling, composting, very simple things that any municipality can engage in.
I want to bring on a couple of callers here towards the end of the program who have resources they want to recommend for people who want to take action, get involved, learn more. Sarah in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hi. I'd like to recommend 350 Bay Area, which is 350.org has little 350. So Bay Area one includes all the cities around here.
Great.
Also, Green Action, one word, Green Action. They work with largely communities of color on climate issues. And then there's the Sierra Club. And how about the Catholic Church? The Pope is on our side. Thank you.
All right, great, Sarah. We will post some of those resources at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. John, welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to mention the Clean Power SF program. Which Sarah mentioned, 350 Bay Area has been, and the Sierra Club have been backing heavily. It's a city program. People can sign up for it now. You have the choice of a 50% renewable for about what PG&E is charging, or for a few dollars more per month, there's the deep green option that's 100% renewable. So people can go online and just Google Clean Power SF, SFPUC, and sign up now.
John, thank you so much for the call. That is what we were about here, is about people bringing together information so that we can all be involved in creating the solutions to these issues. And I want to thank our guests today on Your Call, Guillermo Rodriguez, Policy and Communications Director for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. Guillermo, great to have had you in studio here to talk about the efforts that San Francisco is making and connections to what's going on in Paris today and through the week.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
Also with us from Paris has been Dr. Elizabeth Sawin. She's co-founder and co-director of Climate Interactive, a nonprofit organization which helps people see what works to address climate change. Dr. Sawin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Great to have you with us. And also, Dr. Kif Scheuer. He's the Climate Change Program Director at the Local Government Commission. Kif, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we will put links not only to all the websites mentioned during the hour, but to the specific organizational links of the folks we've had on as guests. Thanks so much. Appreciate you listening. Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back tomorrow. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss Exxon's role in funding science that denies the impacts of climate change. An email from an in-house climate scientist revealed that Exxon may have known about the dangers of climate change as early as 1981. Is it time for Congress to investigate Exxon about its campaign to bury the truth about climate change? Who has the power to make it happen? And what could the implications be for the world's largest energy company? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.